Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Nathan Seisman. Welcome, Nathan.
Thanks for having me.
And on our show today, we're going to be having a really fascinating conversation. We're going to be talking with Lauren Lux, director of the University of North Carolina Lineberger's Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Support Program, and Nicholas Steiner, co-founder and board member of the Be Loud Sophie Foundation, about how Steiner's daughter, Sophie, inspired a new approach to helping teens and young adults face a life-altering diagnosis when she, unfortunately, was facing cancer and subsequently succumbed to it. A really important program that affects not just our hospital, but affects hospitals across the United States.
Absolutely. This happens all over the country all the time, sadly.
And it is sad. And childhood cancers, particularly the kind of the teen cancers, they're not really pediatric cancers. They're not really adult cancers. And these kids have special needs. And we're going to really be able to dive deep and understand it better and know why these types of programs are needed.
That sounds great.
First, let's talk about some research that matters. And our very first one is about breast implants and an increased risk of blood cancer.
That's right. And this is a very rare type of blood cancer, the anaplastic large cell lymphoma, that appears to be associated with certain types of breast implants.
Yeah, this was actually in the Journal of the American Medical Association's subspecialty journal called Oncology. And it was really looking at this very aggressive form of what's called non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This is a cancer of the white blood cells, usually affects people who are older, actually is more common in men than women. And this was actually a Danish study that looked at cases of this non-Hodgkin, particularly lymphoma of the breast from 1990 to 2016. And among 43 patients who had this anaplastic large cell lymphoma, rare lymphoma, 32 had had breast implants compared to only one among 146 patients who had other types of breast lymphomas. That's concerning.
It really is, especially, I mean, even though there's a small number of patients in this particular sample, it's still striking the numbers that were associated with the breast implants.
This isn't the first study that's actually looked at this. There's been studies now going back 6-7 years, and the World Health Organization has now recognized that this may be a consequence of these breast implants. There was some research that certain types, what they call the macro-textured implants, may pose a bigger risk than the micro-textured implants. And we should also say that this is a rare cancer, and breast implants provide benefits for so many women who would not be able to get these benefits otherwise. And so it's not something that should be scary, but it is something to be informed of, and you probably need to talk with your surgeon about this.
Yeah, like most things in medicine, it's a risk-benefit conversation.
And to our knowledge, I don't think there's other cancers that have been really linked or associated, and it's hard to know exactly what maybe is. And this is not a causal study, but it's a strong enough association that there are some warnings out there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is actually about new research that I think will change what you and I may do. And certainly if we ever needed treatment for a stroke, it might change what we get.
Yeah, so this is research that is talking about how long doctors have to respond to strokes.
And typically we think of if you come into the hospital and you've had your stroke more than 6 hours ago, doctors would take it seriously, but they wouldn't necessarily put you through the protocols that might encourage you to get a chemical that could dissolve the clot, which if it's within the first couple hours, they would be all over and that would be offered to you. This, what are they thinking about changing and why here?
Well, the traditional thinking is that the stroke causes millions of neurons to die each and every minute after that window period that you're talking about. And then beyond that window period, it really wasn't worth saving the brain as the brain cells were dead. That is showing that may not be as accurate, that other blood vessels in the brain may be taking up the slack.
And so they now have research that would suggest that it could be as long as 16 hours in some cases, maybe 24 hours in some cases. They had two different studies. Both of these studies showed that interventions could occur later. And then the very same week, the Stroke Association issued new national guidelines to suggest that if you come in and you've had a stroke, but it's been kind of less than 24 hours, you still may benefit. You should be offered this treatment. That doesn't mean everyone would choose to have this treatment because the treatment could have some side effects too. But I think this is changing what's going to happen.
Absolutely. And when it comes to stroke and the brain, any extra time is good.
And the key is really if you think you're having a stroke, if your loved one you think is having a stroke, get to the emergency room quickly. This is not one of those things where you want to send your doctor a note with our EHR, electronic health record, my chart, that says at 6 p.m., something's happening in the family here. Could you get back to me, let me know, and I see it at 6 a.m. the next morning. Don't want to go there. Our last research that matters is one that, well, let me see what you think. This research about bottled water. Do you drink bottled water?
I do.
I do as well. Do you have a certain brand?
No.
Any brand?
Any brand.
I tend to go for the cheapest brand.
Yeah, that's usually me too.
Now, when you go out to a restaurant where you get the bottled water, you'll do tap water. And why is that?
Because it's water.
Well, we're probably in the minority. I kind of share that belief. But this would say that, and this was out of the University of Waterloo, our colleagues north of the United States, that a fear of dying and a desire for immortality drives people's purchases of bottled water. Do you believe it?
I mean, it sounds like the Fountain of Youth to me.
And they did actually a content analysis. They kind of looked at bottled water campaigns and advertisements, websites, photographs, and videos. And they said that there are all these implicit messages of these incredible health benefits to play up on our fear of dying and that promise something that really is not able to deliver, which is overall better health through the use of bottled water. I believe that there's more to this than probably people realize.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, it's funny. I had this experiment with my family members. We were out at a restaurant. I said, you know, I don't think you can tell the difference between bottled water and tap water. We got lined up four things there. They could have bottled water, tap water. Now, they could tell the difference. Now, I'm not sure that means that they think that it gave them better overall immortality. But obviously, people can tell differences as to whether those differences have true meaningful health impacts. Hard to say, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, throughout history, people have spent a lot of their time looking for clean water. So there may be some tie-in to our evolutionary past. Who knows?
Certainly, it's an expensive proposition. No doubt about that. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Lauren Lux, director of UNC Lineberger's Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Support Program, and Nicholas Steiner, co-founder and board member of the Be Loud Sophie Foundation, about Sophie Steiner and her campaign when she was undergoing cancer to transform and successfully has the way teens and young adults face a life-altering diagnosis. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Nathan Sison. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Lauren Lux, director of the University of North Carolina Lineberger's Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Support Program, and Nicholas Steiner, co-founder and board member of the Be Loud Sophie Foundation, about how Steiner's daughter, Sophie, inspired a new approach to helping teens and young adults facing a life-altering diagnosis. Welcome, Nicholas and Lauren.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's really our pleasure, and this is such an important work that you're doing. And, you know, we normally start off by understanding a little bit about the people who are here, but I think today it We should understand Sophie. Nicholas, tell us about your daughter.
Well, thank you for asking. That's kind of you. She's described by many of our friends who knew her as an old soul. She liked to sit at home and drink tea and snuggle up with books. That's one thing to know about her. She also was a fabulous photographer. She had a great eye for certain things. If you go to our website, you can see some of the photos. But then she also had this bracing honesty, which you had to be aware of, because you could come home with a shirt that you had just bought with great enthusiasm, and you better be ready for her to offer you her comments on that shirt. And that's important to note, because everything we try to do with Be Loud is in the spirit of Sophie and honoring who she was. And so authenticity is a sort of a central theme to what we're doing.
And she developed cancer at a really young age, an aggressive, difficult-to-treat cancer.
She just started ninth grade at East Chapel High and then was in treatment for 10 months and died in August of 2013.
And there was something about the essence, the spirit of what you described, that the community really rallied not just about her but about that spirit. Can you just maybe mention for our listeners, how did the community capture that essence, and how did that support come through to you and your family and Sophie?
It really started at the very beginning at the memorial service. We asked people in lieu of flowers to contribute to a Sophie Fund, and we didn't really know what that Sophie Fund was going to be. We thought it would buy some gas cards for patients who were less fortunate than us. And within weeks, we had thousands of dollars, and within about 2-3 months, we had $70,000.
Amazing.
Amazing. And inspiring. We stepped back and said, wait a minute, we can do more than just a fund. And it was actually our youngest daughter, Annabelle, and said, that's right, we need to start a foundation. And we thought, well, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And, of course, when you have a foundation, you quickly need a name. And we quickly settled on Be Loud, which is a line from one of the poems she wrote. And four lines from that poem are, be loud and move with grace, explode with light and have no fear. Those words resonate so much with me and my family and I think our community.
And to hear those type of words from a young child, a daughter who's dealing with cancer, and to say have no fear, a way of moving forward in the world, that's amazing.
It was amazing how she handled cancer, because she was a bit of a whiner before she got cancer. I mean, she quickly complained it was too cold or too hot or whatever. From the day she got diagnosed, she never complained. She somehow found this extraordinary inner strength, and she just took it. She just took it. And the doctors were amazing. The nurses were amazing. But they did everything they possibly could for her, which involved so many operations, so many procedures. And she just took it. And I don't quite know how she did. And I think that strength has been a big inspiration for us to carry forth.
I know the name Be Loud has such resonance, such meaning. As we hear it, it sends kind of shivers a little bit, because it says, don't go silently. Don't take what's happening to you. And I want to bring you in, Lauren. How did you get involved, and when did you first meet the family and first hear about Sophie?
So I had been in Durham for a few years and was working. I'm a clinical social worker, and a friend of mine passed along this job opportunity for an adolescent and young adult cancer liaison, I think was the name that was settled on for the initial job. And I had always worked in oncology and always felt very passionately about working with especially teens and young adults. They're my favorite age group to work with. And that was my intention when I went to social work school, was to work in the oncology world. So when I saw this job description, I thought, there's no way that this is a real thing. This is an actual job that exists in the world that I can apply for. And I did, and was fortunate enough to get through kind of the first couple rounds of interviews. And I met the Steiners on the day of my in-person interview at UNC and had lunch with them, and was immediately taken aback by them as a family. I've worked with a lot of family foundations in my career, and I was so impressed by their poise and intelligence and connectedness and the homework that they had done on the topic and really their ability to take Sophie's story and create something larger than Sophie and larger than her experience and really cast this broader net and start to understand the adolescent and young adult cancer world. And I was especially impressed by their daughters who were also at the interview. And Annabelle asked some really tough questions. I mean, she was she 15 at the time?
She was young.
She was young. And she asked
Do you remember a question either?
She asked some really legitimate interview questions. So she said, you know, tell me about a time when you had trouble connecting with a teenager or a young adult. And that's a great question and one that I was so excited to answer, but not necessarily one that you expect to come out of a 14 or 15-year-old's mouth. She also asked me a really relevant question about my preference between People Magazine versus Us Weekly. And that felt like a pretty important thing to have discussion about.
And you answered it right.
I didn't know I answered it right, but apparently
was the right answer?
It was really helpful.
I think when you're feeling intellectual, you go for People Magazine.
Yeah.
But when you want just a straight-up
Beach Read,
US Weekly.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed meeting them, and I kind of left that day feeling really excited about the opportunity and was fortunate enough to be offered the position. And I still can't believe that it's my job. And it's morphed into so much more than I think what was on that initial job description on that piece of paper that first day that we all met. And it's been such an honor and privilege to be able to do that and mold it and shape it and have partners like the Steiners and like people at UNC that I work with and around the country really in shaping what our program is now.
Well, I know we're going to really dive in to understand the program, but I kind of want to go back again to perhaps how Sophie, I know that she saw this need. She saw, and I know in some of the materials, Nicholas, that she said this was really something that she wanted and knew that this was an issue. Tell me about when that awareness, you think, and how that came about.
That awareness came about on day one when Sophie realized that a children's hospital is really fantastic for children, for three-year-olds and five-year-olds. But when you're 14, 15, it's not really geared towards you. And a lot of adolescents and young adults will tell you that. And once you're over 18, you can go to the adult hospital. But Ian Davis, Sophie's doctor, said, I think virtually every single patient who could graduate to the adult hospital ultimately comes back. Because as irritating as the children's hospital might be, the adult hospital is just downright depressing if you're 19 and you're really only there with 60 and 70 and 80-year-olds. So Sophie just realized the hospital didn't have enough for her age group. And that's when she started talking about wanting to have a legacy. We all start thinking about what would that be? And that was to change the hospital in such a way that it offers more for that age group.
Well, we're going to really dive in and understand what it is you're doing. What are the challenges? What are the things that really wake up each day and say, I have to do this. But we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue talking with Lauren Lux and Nicholas Steiner, director of UNC Lineberger's Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Support Program and co-founder and board member of the Be Loud Sophie Foundation, about how Sophie inspired a new approach to helping teens and young adults facing a life-altering diagnosis. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with Lauren Lux, director of the University of North Carolina's Lineberger's Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Support Program, and Nicholas Steiner, co-founder and board member of the Be Loud Sophie Foundation, about Nicholas's daughter Sophie and her unfortunate early death, but how her death inspired a new approach to helping teens that Lauren is helping lead around the state of North Carolina and probably beyond the boundaries of a state. And we were just before the break, Nicholas, you were talking about how Sophie saw these gaps that were happening for this population of teens, maybe young adults, in a hospital that she was really beyond what we think for pediatrics, but she certainly was not the adults, that it, between the irritating and the depressing kind of space there. What were you seeing, and how did, you know, help us understand what the sort of things, how you envisioned Lauren's position, and we'll find out how it works on a daily basis.
We saw very well-intentioned volunteers rolling in art carts that are geared towards 3 and 5 year olds, just not for 15 year olds. We saw clowns come through. We saw musicians come through. Again, very, very wonderful for younger kids, or maybe some 15 year olds, but just not for Sophie. She just wanted to be treated more like an adult. And I think that's what's so hard at this age group, right? You're just starting to figure out who you are, your identity, and growing independence from your parents. And then you're diagnosed with cancer, and all that is stripped away, and you're confined to a hospital bed with no dignity, no independence. And I think that's what's so difficult about this age group. You can't advocate for yourself yet very easily. You're under 18, so the doctors have to talk to your parents about things that maybe you don't want them to talk about.
But yet you have to allow your daughter to still be a teen, right, and develop some independence.
Right. So really helping teens maintain their sense of dignity and independence and identity while undergoing cancer treatment is a major goal of the Be Loud Sophie Foundation and this fabulous program that Lauren and her colleagues are running at Lineberger.
Tell us, Lauren, give us an example of some of the things that you're dealing with now on a daily basis. You know, that the complexity of cancer and the coordination of care, that alone would
right.
be difficult enough, but
right.
yet you have lots of other things that are going on.
Yeah, so I think speaking about our clinical work, which is our work with patients, I think is a great place to start. And I think that what Nicholas said really remains true of what our focus is on a day-to-day basis, which is we want cancer to be a part of people's story, not their whole story. And how do we, in a time of transition in their life, make sure that they're continuing to, even if it's baby steps, take steps along that developmental trajectory so that they're growing and developing and continuing to have peer relationships and trying to figure out who they are, even though they've had this major pause in life, which we hope is just a pause, and that they can come back to their life afterwards. And I think it's really interesting because we work with people age 13 to 30, and that young adult group is equally as challenging to try and navigate the healthcare landscape and a disease like cancer. You know, you're in college or you're working an hourly job and all of a sudden you get sick, and the question, there are all these question marks about what do I do? How do I pay for this? What does this look like? For instance, we see all the folks who are stationed in the military in North Carolina come to UNC for their cancer care. And oftentimes what that means for them is that somewhere in their cancer treatment process or at the end of it, they're discharged and retired from the military. And some of these folks were planning on being lifelong military service members. So figuring out what is next in life after you have had this sort of vision of what your life is going to be and it was interrupted is really challenging. And regardless of if you're in the military or you're a high school junior, cancer is an interruption. That's the probably nicest thing that you can call it. And figuring out what your life looks like afterwards is hard. And it's really a challenge to figure that out. So clinically, kind of on a day-to-day basis, we meet all newly diagnosed patients. I meet people age 13 to 30 in the adult and pediatric hospitals, introduce them to other folks their age if they're interested in that, kind of normalize the process for them in a really abnormal situation, provide a lot of education about what this is, how they can advocate for themselves.
I imagine, you know, we think about survivorship and we think yeah. about it in terms of, well, hopefully more and more of the patients you see will be survivors. But we also know that the family members, regardless of what happens with the patient, are survivors and living on. And so you have to be thinking, I imagine, not only about the person in front of you, you have to be thinking about this extended family. The Steiner family
right.
Would have been all part of your
Right.
Right?
Right. So I think a lot of what we do is some translation services between parents and kids too, or caregivers and patients, in that, you know, it's really normal, for instance, and I didn't get the chance to know Sophie, but I imagine this would be something that happened with her and her family. It's very normal for a 16 or 17 year old to say, yeah, I know I have a chemo admission scheduled for tomorrow, but that's my high school dance and I'm not doing that. So you guys are going to need to figure that out, because I'm not going to go. I'm not coming into the hospital for that. I'm going to go to my dance. And that's really normal. And we actually want to celebrate that and support it as much as we can. Right.
That's part of being loud, saying no.
Exactly. And it's actually as frustrating as it can be for healthcare providers, who I think, we know, we really like things to happen on our schedule because we have tight schedules. Having that flexibility and encouraging that flexibility and independence is something that we try to do.
And let me ask you, Nicholas, when you and your wife, Lucy, set up this foundation, your vision was not just providing clinical services, which would have been more than enough. You have a broader vision about education and research, too. And I know that you, through your work at the university, research and education are really central to who you are professionally.
Right. But you're giving us too much credit at the origin. I have to tell you, we didn't really know what we wanted, except that Sophie's experience in the hospital was made more bearable because we lived 7 minutes away and we had so many family and friends to come to the hospital. And she saw patients lying there alone, her age, from Roanoke Rapids for days on end. And she realized that's not right. That's what we wanted to address. And we realized everyone needs a kind of network that we were able to provide for Sophie. And the best thing we could come up with was to hire someone like Lauren inside the hospital. Very beginning, we thought, well, we can kind of keep pushing resources into the hospital. If someone wants a guitar player or a field hockey player to come visit them, that'd be fine. But we realized, no, we need someone in the hospital to pull all these strings together. Because actually, as it turns out, and Lauren has discovered this, there are a number of great resources in the hospital already, but they're so decentralized, so spread out, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. So it's taken someone like Lauren to be a coordinator, a facilitator of so many resources, whether they're in the pediatric hospital or in the adult hospital. So a lot is already there. It just had to be pulled together.
And those are physically pretty far apart.
Exactly.
Regardless, I'm sure you get a lot of exercise. I know that you have a vision of making this more available. Tell us a little bit about that vision and how you've evolved.
Sure.
So what we wanted to make sure that everyone understands the value of Lauren and her colleagues, that it's not just a nice-to-have thing. It's actually integral to the well-being of the patients and to improve their outcomes. So that's where the research comes in, and I think that's where Lauren can speak about how she and her colleagues have started implementing.
Because every hospital who sees this population, which is just about every hospital that treats cancer, really needs to seriously consider how it goes about making these types of resources available to patients and families.
Exactly.
Yeah. How are you doing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's helpful to understand a little bit of the adolescent and young adult cancer care landscape in the U.S. So this is a relatively new sort of subspecialty in the cancer world in the last 10, 15 years or so. And really in the last 5 years have we seen it start to explode. There are about 70,000 new AYAs diagnosed each year in the U.S.,
and that would be adolescents and young adults.
Yep.
Okay.
And we know that actually a lot of them aren't treated at major academic medical centers. So part of this unique position that we're in North Carolina is that we have taken, and I'll backtrack in a minute, but we have taken what we've been able to do at UNC, and we're really starting to think about how do we reach out to other providers in the community across the state. So we're really excited. We're going to have a symposium, the first North Carolina Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Care Symposium on April 27th here in Chapel Hill for providers across the state. Extremely excited to offer that for the first time. Hopefully it will be the first of many years of that to come. And it really fits nicely into the sort of broader picture of our program. So I like to think of our program as having sort of five different areas that we try to tackle. The clinical piece we've talked about, there's an education and training piece, right? How do we educate the workforce to be better prepared to deal with this patient population and their unique medical and psychosocial needs? There's a research piece. There is a policy and process piece. Let's look at the way things are happening within the hospital system and how we can make that work better for this age group. And there is an advocacy piece. What does that look like on a statewide, on a national level, and how do we integrate all of these things together?
Sounds like at times you need to be irritating and disruptive. You need to act like a teen and sometimes think like an adult or this combination. I think before we end, you know, as I'm reflecting on having a child with cancer, and I think unless one's really had that and experienced it, it's, one really can't understand. But from an outsider looking in, I can say, you know, that it appears to me that Sophie's life was not defined by cancer. It was defined by the work that inspired the work that you're doing now. And to me, that it's just so inspiring and empowering. And I don't know if you have some final thoughts yourselves, because, you know, it makes me want to go out and support the work you're doing.
Thank you so much for saying that. You know, it's, of course, it's a great tragedy, but Sophie's life was a success. Sophie's life was too short, but it was a success. And I think all that we're been able to achieve since her death is a testament to that.
I have a great photo, Nicholas and Lucy. There was a photography display of Sophie's work, and they were kind enough to offer one of the photos to me to take home, and I could pick whichever one. It was so hard to choose. They're beautiful. But the one that I saw and knew immediately that I have to have and that I look at every day when I walk in my front door is it must have been a raindrop or a pebble or something that fell into water, and Sophie captured the ripple that happened in the water when that object hit it. And when I saw that, it just immediately impacted me, because that was, I feel like that is what Sophie has been able to do. Her experience and her idea was this drop in the water, and the ripple that has happened from that over the last 2.5 years is just outstanding. It's really incredible the amount of change that's been able to take place in the work that we've been able to do from that small drop into the water. So I get to see that every day when I get home, and it sort of, for me, perfectly captures her legacy and the Steiner family and what they've been able to accomplish.
Well, we so appreciate, on behalf of your health, being able to celebrate memories, celebrate the work, and recognize that a dedication and recommitment to providing the sorts of things for future generations. And for that, we're really grateful to the Steiner family and to Lauren and the Cancer Center for the work that you're doing.
It's kind of you to have us on. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, but we're going to be continuing with your health when we return. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Nathan and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I was recently diagnosed with sleep apnea through a sleep test. I saw in the report that they said I had obstructive sleep apnea. What does that mean, and does it mean that there's something wrong with my lungs?
No, is the answer, I think, to that question usually. Sleep apnea or obstructive sleep apnea comes from an obstruction in the upper airways, and it's usually from people who are either obese and have deposited fat in that area, or just from the way your anatomy is.
That is the most common type of sleep apnea that people have, usually associated with things like snoring and where your palate kind of obstructs the upper airway. The problem is that it will put some strain on the heart ultimately, and potentially the lungs, And most times we're really talking about the difference between obstructive sleep apnea and central sleep apnea, which is not as frequent, and other types of conditions that can cause central sleep apnea. Like obstructive sleep apnea, we think of with things like obesity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the most common cause.
Yeah. Central sleep apnea would really be kinds of things that would cause people to have some conditions where their brain quits breathing, something inside the brain stem. Sometimes people have that type of apnea with certain types of breathing. Sometimes when they're really quite sick, people who are older, sometimes heart failure can cause that. So it would be more concerned perhaps if you actually had central sleep apnea, because the obstructive sleep apnea, one of the great treatments is pretty simple. Weight loss if you're overweight. That can cure it. Thank you so much. And what's our very next house call?
I recently went to the dermatologist for treatment of seborrhea on my face. He gave me topical steroid cream and it got better for the first few days, but then it got a lot worse and I'm breaking out on my cheeks and chin worse than ever. What do you think's going on and should I get a second opinion?
Well, certainly something's going on because you got worse when a treatment was given. And I always say that when you get worse with the treatment, there are kind of one of three things that could be going on. One is you got the wrong, you know, medicine. The second is you got the wrong diagnosis. Or the third, you got the right medicine, but you didn't get it in the right dose. So let's figure out which of those things could be going on here. Chances are if you saw the dermatologist, the medicine was in the right dose. I doubt that they gave a medicine that wasn't strong enough.
Yeah, that's unlikely. What's more likely going on is that the diagnosis is wrong, or maybe you have another diagnosis in addition to what this is treating.
Yeah, sometimes we see that when you give topical steroids on the face, it might help initially, but sometimes people can get a side effect to the topical steroids. We sometimes get what's called a perioral dermatitis. You get little bumps around your face and mouth. We see that a lot in people who've been taking like hydrocortisone cream, pretty low-dose steroid, but they've been using it for a couple of weeks. Maybe they had a breakout of something, that's gone away, and now they have these bumps there. And the treatment of that is to stop the steroid. What else could be going on?
Like I said, another diagnosis. Perhaps something else is going on in the face that steroids make worse.
Like rosacea.
Like rosacea.
Rosacea, common condition that actually it's acne-like, but you put steroid cream on it and it usually gets worse. So it looks like seborrhea. It's not so easy to tell the difference from seborrhea in the same distribution on the face. In this case, probably going back to see the doctor to let them know it got worse, because rosacea has a different treatment, right?
It does. It does. Antibiotics, topical antibiotics are typically used.
Yeah, not steroids. So thank you for that question. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I wanted to write in just to say that your messages of lifestyle changes to improve health actually do sometimes work. I'm 82 and have always been overweight and probably drank more than was healthy. Over the past year, I've made a real effort to lose weight, start exercising, and cut back on alcohol. I visit a gym about 3 times a week, and I'm proud to say my weight went from 193 to 170, and my blood pressure dropped from above normal to well below.
That's actually pretty nice to hear.
It is.
We take for granted sometimes that the advice of lifestyle change is easy to do, which it's not, but yet it's the most powerful medication we have.
It is, and it's the single medication that puts the power into the patient's hands too.
And physical activity, we know that it has benefits at almost every level, even the low intensity physical activity. We know weight loss can have benefits on so many health conditions. Quitting smoking, single greatest thing one can do for one's health, and reducing alcohol, even lower amounts of alcohol for some people could raise their risk of cancers.
Yeah, that's right.
For all of our listeners out there, we would encourage you to take heart of this success story. And I think in this case, this is someone who was even older. Laura was how? Did
82.
82. Wow.
Never too late.
Never too late. Well, we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've answered questions and concerns that are important to you. And Nathan, if any of our listeners want to write to us, they can at yourhealth@unc.edu. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank Nathan, guest co-host today. Also, our guests today, Lauren Lux and Nicholas Steiner. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Nathan Sisson.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.